We have never agreed for our lands to be invaded or occupied. We have never consented to it, and we will never, ever surrender or compromise. We occupied government buildings, we blockaded highways, and we talked about not just marching, but direct action to shut this shit down.
Here we draw the line. Right here we say no more.
Welcome to Indigenous Action, where we dig deep into critical issues impacting our communities throughout occupied America, Turtle Island. This is an autonomous, anti-colonial broadcast with unapologetic and clause-out analysis towards total liberation. So take your seat by this fire, and may the bridges we burn together light our way.
Oka, hello everybody. My name is Bon and my pronouns are they, them. I'm really excited today because I'm going to actually be your unhost for this broadcast because we're doing a takeover. And I have three really amazing, brilliant, and fierce Afro-Indigenous badass guests today to shut down the anti-blackness shit that we've been witnessing in our communities, not just over the past several months, but also way before the George Floyd uprisings. To introduce our guests today, we have Shanice, who is a gay as fuck Afro-Indigenous Kwe. We have Edzi, who not only provides us with deep critical analysis of everything from cis sexism to colorism, but also shows up on the front lines in our resistance efforts. And we also have Malaika, who is an eco-influencer and an incredible poet. And so I really seriously cannot wait to hear from these amazing people. And to start us off with the takeover today, I'd really love to hear from y'all something that seems to always be kind of a roadblock in creating true and meaningful solidarity for Black and Indigenous people. And it's kind of like we always approach our struggles for the most part. I know we have examples of what Black and Indigenous solidarity has looked like on the ground and in community, and we have beautiful examples of that. But for the most part, I tend to see our struggles existing in silos. And so something that Malaika has said that has really always stuck out to me is that we won't have Indigenous sovereignty without Black liberation, and we won't have Black liberation without Indigenous sovereignty. So, Malaika, why don't you go ahead and get us started really just let us know what you would tell our listeners, what you mean by that.
Sego, Skinangoa, Malaika Wairi, Amalie Gad Hagkas Maskwe, Yonkyats, Haudenosaunee, Ganyangahaga, Ganawage, Mi'kmaq, Elsi, Gogok, Mi'kma'ki, Gespukwich, Wat'gaho, Oswego, Tikarando. So, hello, I carry the peace. My name is Malaika Wairi. My spirit name is the one who stands Mo'ak, Shone Ganyangahaga, or you may know as, Mohawk. And I'm also Mi'kmaq First Nations. And I guess how I view those words is just from a place of understanding that these movements are not exclusive. They are complementary. And thinking about the fact that enslaved Africans were neither settlers or indigenous Turtle Island, but they were indigenous, to Africa, to the motherland, right? We have multiple motherlands. And when we're thinking about our being in relation as Black and Indigenous folks, especially now, you know, there's just so much around, as was mentioned, the siloing, and this notion that, you know, for some reason we are each kind of in these separate movements towards our self-determination, essentially. But we have to remember that we are intertwined in a very complex relationship that was forged, for the most part, due to colonization, you know, due to the simple fact that, you know, this capitalistic ruling class is continually moving towards a genocidal erasure of Indigenous peoples and land theft, and the continual exploitation and commodification of the labor of people of African descent. And so that means that if we're looking at abolition, if we're speaking abolition, if we're speaking sovereignty, if we're speaking land back, if we're speaking reparations and liberations, then we need to be speaking to each other and really think about, what does a contemporary, you know, intercommunal wampum agreement look like that focuses on our being in relation to Mother Earth? Because ultimately, that's what we're all talking about. Indigenous people are talking about sovereignty in relation to the redistribution of wealth and jurisdictional power within the settler state, and having, you know, to be able to self-determine how we navigate, you know, our relationships in our territories, and how we continue to protect the land, steward the land and the water, and how we create sustainable economies in relation to the earth and all it provides. And Black folks are also looking at receiving what was essentially promised by the labor in which they gave freely on this land and at the expense of their lives and their lineage. And so we have to kind of reconcile the fact that we cannot move forward in any way unless we are doing it together, and unless we begin to speak to the intergenerational harm that we have caused each other, and that we are continuing to cause each other. In the form of anti-Blackness, in the form of, you know, anti-Indigenous racism. I'm going to turn it over to my colleagues, my kin.
Oki itamikskanatani, good morning. I'm Edzi. I'm of Afro-Indigenous Blackfeet and Filipina trans feminine person, Two-Spirit identifying to, and yeah, currently residing in Tongva lands. I think what I really usually like to make sure people acknowledge and are aware of, in terms of the political education that I put about when it comes to anti-Blackness, is differentiating the difference between white supremacy and anti-Blackness. And when discussing anti-Blackness, a lot like Blackness, it is centering the experiences of people who are of the African diaspora, even of the Australian diaspora, and just acknowledging that some of the first intentions around the theories of anti-Blackness have always criticize liberal humanism. And when I say that, I mean acknowledging that the concept of human is actually part and parcel of the colonial project that separates us from not only the land, but also from our quote-unquote non-human relatives, and has historically sustained not only white supremacy, but what human supremacy and human dominance. I think, yeah, a lot of our relatives that don't have the faculties to necessarily voice in language that we understand their opinions or of like what we're doing to the world, I think there deserves to be some decentralization of like of importance and sacredness when it comes to other non-human relatives, but also criticizing the very nature of what we understand as humanhood, you know. And I get a lot of weird pushback from people when I talk about or criticize humanhood or humanity. It makes me sound kind of like a supervillain or something, wanting to abolish the idea of humanity. But it's more so abolishing the idea that we are the most important beings on this planet, which is, you know, like something that our ancestors, pre-colonization, would understand. And also then relating our struggles to one another, seeing not only Black people and Indigenous people as relatives in the struggle for liberation. But yeah, having a clear insight as to what structures of power and institutions have facilitated not only colonization, but this, you know, so-called human supremacy that I speak of, that is inherently white, Eurocentric, dogmatic, canon, Western, binary, imperialist, white supremacist, capitalist, cisnormative, heteropatriarchy, all of the systems of domination facilitated by the so-called West.
Chimwe Gwich for that. My name is Shanice. So Anim Bojo Buju, Shanice Ndishnakas, and Dobrogo Nishn Bamlang, Jack and Dodam, Anishnabe Makade Kwe, Toronto, Dunjaba Minwa Nabising, Dunjaba, Dibenjigan Nakuya Mississaugek. So my name is Shanice Steele. I am Afro-Indigenous. My father comes from Trinidad with ties to Karakou, Grenada. And my mom is a Anishinaabe Métis, Nipissing to be exact, or Nabising. I am Crane Clan. My Anishinaabe name is Ndobo, which means to carry the ceremony. I'm currently in Etobicoke, or North York, as other folks know it. We're part of Toronto, and we're on the traditional territory of the Mississaugek or Mississaugas, and under the Dish with One Spoon Wampum. And so, honestly, like, listening to folks who've already spoken, I'm like, damn, is there anything else I can actually add? Because I'm just like, y'all just dropping knowledge. But I think, honestly, I be hearing folks talk and I'm just like, what do I even have left to say? But I think for me, when we're looking at the way in which white supremacy and colonialism and Eurocentric ideals have been applied to these lands, it has stolen kinship from us and relationships and relationship to the land, relationship to other beings on these lands, but also relationship to each other. And I think specifically when we're talking in a Canadian context, right, or what we now see as Canada, is there is very often this separation of Black Indigenous folks and Indigenous folks to these territories. There's no there's no relationship spoken of. I feel like when we look at an American colonial context, there's lots of conversations that are had about the history of, you know, Native Americans and African Americans on these lands. But when it comes to a Canadian context, unless we're talking about Nova Scotia, we completely erase the history of that shared relationship and that shared history here. And we don't talk about the displacement of, you know, Afro-Caribbean folks and folks from the African continent who have come here, oftentimes not of their own will. And what that does to be displaced multiple times. I'm someone whose father is an immigrant to these lands. And I think about the reason why my grandmother had to leave Trinidad and the colonialism and white supremacy and colorism that was taking place there that forced her to leave and come here. And I often think, you know, when we're thinking of places to escape as Black folks, we very rarely think of Africa. We very rarely think of returning to our indigenous homelands, right? I don't know how many African Americans I've heard through this past election, talk about, well, I'm just going to escape to Canada. And there's never this conversation about what it means in a real way to reconnect to land and indigeneity. But I also think about how Black folks see these lands, or see some of these lands as a safe space, as a place to love and to form family and community. And it makes me think of all of the ways in which Indigenous people to these territories have created that understanding of these lands, right? Because the idea that these lands are a place of welcoming, of love, of hope, that's not something that Europeans brought to us. That's not something that white folks have instilled, right? That welcoming is something that we inherently have as Indigenous peoples to these territories. When we read those first accounts of European settlers coming here, their first accounts were that we welcomed them with open arms, that we taught them how to survive on these lands, that we, you know, saved them. If it wasn't for us, they would not be here. I mean, it's a double-edged sword when you think about it. But at the same time, we have fostered that nature and that ideal and that welcoming of open arms to others. That is something that we created on these lands, that we continue to open up on these lands. And I think sometimes we forget that sometimes because of white supremacy, because of the borders that have been pushed on us, because of the way we even have to talk about land back, right? Because the way we talk about land back often sometimes sounds a little colonial. It sounds like the same conversation that white people are having, right? We're saying, well, we were the traditional owners of these lands. We did not own these lands, right? Mm-hmm. We were caretakers of these lands, but we've been forced to talk about it in a very colonial way. And it causes us to forget that initial relationship that we had to newcomers, to others. And then that creates that anti-Blackness that we're now seeing in a lot of our communities towards Black folks. Right, mm-hmm. That lack of understanding, of welcoming, of opening, of love, of kinship, of relationship. And then on the other side, Black folks, right, after being displaced multiple times, because I think we think of, like, Black displacement as, like, a one-time thing, like they were displaced from Africa and then brought here, or brought to the Caribbean. But when you think about it, they were displaced multiple times, right? Indigenous folks in Africa were taken from their tribe and their community, and they were displaced from place to place to place before they were even shipped over to the Americas, to the Caribbean. And then once here, they were displaced again and again and again and again. This is generations of displacement, mm-hmm. multiple generations of displacement, and that disconnect from land. Right. Yeah. And then having to recreate that relationship over and over again to new places, it makes it hard for Black folks to trust those relationships. We've been displaced so many times and separated from family and land and community so many times that mm-hmm. oftentimes it's hard for us to relate in that same way. It's not that we can't, because we sure as hell do in many different places. But I think that's where we start to see, you know, this butting of the heads between Black and Indigenous peoples on these lands, is that the way in which colonialism and white supremacy and Eurocentric ideals have affected us and have infested our communities is that it's caused that breakdown of relationship and kinship. So I'm going to leave it at that. But yeah, I I definitely wanted to talk about that.
Absolutely. Shanice, I love Shanice. I think, yeah, I think it's like we're so suspect of each other. Like, even, you know, let's take it now to, like, right now in this moment of, like, the movement. I mean, there are so many times where I've been on the front lines, even just over the last 8 months, both for Black Lives Matters, you know, mobilizations around, you know, police brutality and stuff. And then also, you know, what's been happening in our Indigenous communities around, you know, land defense, you know, particularly we think about, you know, for me personally, what's happening with Six Nations, 1492 land back, and my Mi'kmaq family and relatives who have been, you know, fighting for their way of life, you know, to be able to sustain themselves. But it's like you can sometimes feel the tension on the front lines where, you know, people are kind of like not always so welcoming about having, you know, Black folks in something that supposedly seems like it's an Indigenous matter and vice versa. And being Afro-Indigenous, I always feel like I'm just like the anomaly. So it's like, you know, I get there and obviously it's like, I'm down for whatever at the end of the day. But it's kind of like, you know, how do I, show up sometimes? I'm like, okay, how am I showing up here and how am I showing up there depending on what the energy is like? And lately I've just been like, clearly I'm just showing up as myself. And I remember when we were doing that huge march in May, I think it was end of May, early June after George Floyd. And we had a sister in here who was Afro-Indigenous, you know, Regis Korchinski Paquette, and actually part of my nation, Mi'kmaq Nation. But in the reports for a good hot minute, she was not being named as Afro-Indigenous. She was just being named as being Black and Ukrainian. And eventually once, you know, that identity became centered a bit. It was just interesting how hard it was actually initially to get Indigenous folks to come and support that initial march. I sent out so many calls, and what ended up happening, and I guess that was, you know, at the end of the day, I think the Creator always makes what happens supposed to happen, but it was a majority Afro-Indigenous contingent, you know, drumming and singing, you know, taking up that space that in many cases has always been dominated by, you know, Indigenous kin. And for the first time in my lifetime, and I've been involved in social action on the front lines for a good decade now, in Tikarando, it's the first time I've ever been in a full kind of like lineup with Afro-Indigenous kin leading the drumming. And there was something beautiful and powerful and just reaffirming, like, yes. But at the same time, I was also saddened that so many of my Indigenous kin didn't show. And it really, you know, so it's kind of like thinking to myself, and then you see on social media that some of it, again, comes down to this oppression Olympics. Why are we competing around oppression, Black people, Indigenous people? This just bothers me to no end. And I know all of you too probably see this on social media and how many times we have to go into someone's comments and be like, hey, you know, no, we're not doing this right now. So that's what I feel when I'm on the front lines. A lot of times I feel the tension of those oppression Olympics. But at the same time, it was so much love to have all these Afro-Indigenous kin just taking up that space, singing the drum songs and not feeling as sometimes we often are, where it's just like, should we be leading the song? Do we defer to our Indigenous kin? There was no deferment. It was like, we're taking the lead. And it was really good.
I definitely agree with you on the, like, lateral violence, the oppression Olympics that takes place. I remember when, you know, the George Floyd protests first started happening, there was these two really prominent Cree, you know, indigenous activists, kind of like in the you know, the native scene, that were making these posts that were like, oh, you can march for Black lives. We better see you marching for Indigenous lives. And I saw that narrative used a lot where it was like, oh, you can march for them, but you're not going to march for us.
Yeah.
That was being pushed everywhere.
Yeah.
And I had actually called one of them out and I was like, this is actually anti-Black. Mm-hmm. And I was like, you know, like I'm not down to play the oppression Olympics while I'm watching folks die around me. Yeah. And at some point, she had responded and she was like, oh, you're really watching people die in front of you? Ooh. And the way she had just like diminished what I was feeling as a Black person around that time, was just, I was like, wow, like we're really not in this together. Like,
no,
because I would never, like, I was like, could you imagine if someone said that about missing and murdered Indigenous women? Like,
exactly.
Could you imagine if that was the response?
Right.
And so I was just like, the fact that you completely diminished what I was going through as a Black person, I was like, okay, I guess this is what we're doing. And, you know, I've had that happen a lot where anytime I've talked about Black issues, I've had, you know, First Nation folks, Native American folks, whichever label folks would like to use, but I've had them be like, well, if you care about Black issues, then that's what you should be focusing on. I had someone once tell me that I should have ran for a racialized constituent position instead of the Indigenous one because I cared too much about Black issues.
Damn.
And so that is something that I've had happen often where, like, the second I start talking about my Blackness or being Afro-Indigenous, or I start talking about, you know, the ways in which anti-Blackness manifests in Indigenous communities, I'm instantly, like, my indigeneity is called into question in, like, a split second. It's like I'm no longer seen as a part of community, a part of my nation, a part of my people. I'm just that Black girl. And it's just been so interesting the way I can just be removed from community like that. But then I've watched where we've had, you know, white folks pretending to, like, being pretend Indians.
Oh, gosh.
There's, like, think pieces, and it's, like, 10 days of going through their ancestry and, like, allowing them to provide proof on their indigeneity. And yet, I'm disposed of so quickly in a way in which white passing natives are not. And that's something that I found really interesting is that, like, that is where we don't talk about that enough, right? And we don't talk about the fact that, you know, sometimes we're not showing up for each other. And what does that mean? And what's the reason for that? And I think when it came to Regis, was that folks were like, oh, well, that's a Black issue. And then when I saw that folks were starting to refer to her as Afro-Indigenous, then it became, well, that's an Indigenous issue. It was like there was no room to be both.
Right.
It's like we were throwing her death back and forth to be like, who gets to claim her? Instead of being like, she's us. She's ours.
Exactly.
Us. We belong to each other. It's like for some reason when we're having these conversations, it's always like, so separate. There's never really that conversation about togetherness. But I think that also comes back to the harm that we have done to each other throughout the years.
Yeah.
And I know it's really easy for us to be like, well, that was the white man. He got us to do that. Yes, at the end of the day, it was white supremacy. It was the white man. But I think what we have to do as communities, as kin, is come together and say, I'm sorry.
Yep.
Like, yes, that harm was done. Not the oppression Olympics of who hurt each other more, but simply, we did that and I'm sorry. We harmed you and I'm sorry. And it's really just that. It's really just acknowledging that and honoring that. And I think people just aren't ready to say, I also participated in white supremacy.
I think that when it
comes to, it's, I like to look at some of the, instead of looking at how, yeah, you were saying, Shanice, how we wronged each other, I think in the kind of like political education work that I've done or do, I try to name who our enemies are and always have been, and you know, bring out and acknowledge the histories and the kinship alliances that have been formed between Black, Indigenous, and Afro-Indigenous peoples. And through that alone, through those histories alone, we should be acknowledging how that kinship makes Black people, even though they have been displaced from, you know, our lands, should also acknowledge that through those kinships and through those alliances and mixing, that has actually re-indigenized us. I do trouble the very notion that, like, even slaves didn't have a connection to the land that they were working, you know, like, mm-hmm. or their ancestors are in these lands too. They've worked the land. They have a real relationship with cotton and sugarcane and all of these indigenous, all of these other herbs and these animals. It's like Black people who were slaves didn't actually develop relationships with people outside of the master who they could. I think I think it's hard to, because I've heard the phrase oppression and Olympics used in different contexts too, in contexts that might then diminish people's responsibility for their own inherent anti-Blackness, and their understanding of what it actually is. I recently was asked to participate in writing part of the statement for the Indigenous Mutual Aid Network. What was fascinating in reading it to other comrades who were creating the statement is, like, after some people read it, an older Indigenous man was like, I guess I had no idea that's what anti-Blackness was. Like, I had no idea that that's, like, it was, it's, it just kind of dawned on him. Part of what I had named in the statement was that, you know, there's a lot of stats that are saying that, like, oh, Indigenous people are the most gunned down by the police in, you know, Turtle Island, and it's hard to hear these kinds of stats and comparisons when I think about historical global slave trade, and how globally Black people everywhere are targeted and gunned down. And, you know, it kind of does often make me need to counter and speak up for Black people specifically. And that seems to be the case in a lot of spaces where I'm the only Afro-Indigenous person, where I'm the only person who's of Black descent. I'm often the person who's, like, has to name or press for that, like, we can't have conversations about reparations without having conversations about our black relatives.
Yes.
And that it's tiring. It's really, really tiring, whether it be, you know, land defense or, you know, simply in, like, you know, mutual aid food programs, yes, or what have you. It's always, like, having to say that in spaces. I've organized in both, you know, exclusively Black place spaces and exclusively Indigenous spaces, and like it's hard. I feel like in the few years that I've done like land defense work, I've noticed a huge lack of Black and Afro-Indigenous peoples. I always was like one of the only ones, if not two other people, and I think that kind of speaks to just where Black people are at in terms of, you know, the weight of anti-Blackness. I wanted to read something from the statement that I wrote, that like many of us acknowledge the colorism that exists, ritualize the value of proximity to whiteness, but have failed to acknowledge the ritualized value of proximity to non-Blackness. So for us growing up, you know, as mixed race people, if we are in predominantly Indigenous spaces or spaces without, you know, our Black relatives or Black people, often at times we were seen as like ugly, or our hair was too coarse, or, you know, like there's all of these things that didn't make us Indigenous or didn't, you know, allow us to be seen as like, you know, part of specific community based on mm-hmm. our proximity to Blackness. And I think that kind of fear, that kind of Negrophobia, is something that, you know, I like to bring forth to speak on, because it isn't, you know, it's something that people aren't thinking about in terms of like, you know, Indigenous people can have a feeling about cultural appropriation, but, you know, where is that same kind of anger mm-hmm. even coming from Black folks when other people are pulling apart or entitled to Black bodies and Black culture? You know, there hasn't been real exchange mm-hmm. of, you know, some of the Black culture that we're seeing online, from like the Ebonics that people are using to how people say words. You know, these are some things that Black people have held on to from Africa, whether it be like our dancing, you know, to how we say words. And it's like, it's like you're upset that like there's Indigenous people that are upset that when they see, you know, a Black person in Indigenous regalia who had complete cultural exchange, you know, with Indigenous cultures, but they're running around these streets talking about, you know, 1738. There's a
huge disconnect around that.
Yeah, and trust. Like when you know, again, during this whole pandemic, plandemic, whatever you want to call it, there were those moments where at least I can say somewhat, you know, some folks within the Indigenous community, particularly in the Indigenous hip hop community, I guess felt like they needed to speak on the fact that they wouldn't be where they are in terms of their careers, their positioning within the music industry if it wasn't for Black culture. Damn. And, you know, it was actually really refreshing to mm-hmm. see a lot of people do it, but they also got pushback. Because then other natives were just like, what are you talking about? Like, hip hop's hip hop. It's like for everybody, you know, it's global, you know, the usual kind of ways in which eventually, you know, Black expression gets, you know, exported, mm-hmm. you know, as this sauce, you know, it's the sauce, right? That makes everything taste good, makes everything pop. but it's like it has an origin, and it comes through a people, it comes through experiences, it comes through, you know, our that DNA, you know what I'm saying? And it's just like you said, in the same way, you know, you're popping off over, you know, and in some cases you should, you know, when you see the cultural appropriation, obviously, but it's just like, again, I agree. There is a double standard there. That's what it seems like to me. And just something that that was touched on around, you know, the fact that, you know, through our interrelation and you know, connecting our lineages, especially during, you know, the early times of enslaved Africans coming over to the Americas and the Caribbean and kind of with indigenous folks, you know, that also was a way of almost re-gifting or reconnecting to an aspect of indigeneity, mm-hmm. which was stripped from us. Mm-hmm. But it's interesting because we, you know, here we are and we still have, you know, folks in different communities who do not have the same rights as their indigenous family members in the same community. Simply because of blood quantum. And, you know, someone posted just, I think today or yesterday around, you know, all of our indigenous relatives who, you know, consider themselves freed people, or they call the term freedmen, right? In terms of tribal membership. And mm-hmm. and what is happening with the fact that they are not having the same access to COVID relief or housing assistance during this time. You know, it really saddens me. This is part of what, you know, Shanice, you were saying, like, we need to apologize. Admit the fact that at some point your nation was involved in the slave, you know, trade, mm-hmm. and in the enslavement of those people, and you have mm-hmm. descendants you need to take care of. I mean, indigenous nations, a lot of indigenous nations, a lot of tribal nations are really quick to adopt white folks. I'm mm-hmm. just saying, mm-hmm. who have yep. no indigeneity. I'm going to speak yep. no indigeneity. Yep. They'll adopt them, and they'll say, you know, that's what we do as indigenous people. We adopt folks. You know, it's part of who we are. You know, but it's just like, but these are actually your kin. And you're not even seeing them as kin simply because they have blackness. It's not acceptable to me. And I know for myself, being both part Mi'kmaq and Haudenosaunee, both those nations, there's a complexity there around blackness. For the Haudenosaunee, mm-hmm. they were one of the nations who had slaves, who had enslaved Africans. So it's and when you try to speak on it, with like a Haudenosaunee person, they don't really want to hear that because they're focused on land back. They're not focused on me getting my life back, you know, in terms of, you know, that legacy of the black side of my family. So it's just so interesting. Like, I have, you know, a grandfather who has lineage of being part of that enslavement, but a grandmother who is part of that community who was the slavers. So it's like, what are we doing? And then on the Mi'kmaq side, it's more of like around land relationship. You know, when the black loyalists, just like south of the Medicine Line, you know, African-American folks, you know, 40 acres and a mule. It was the same thing here. The black loyalists were told, you know, you fought on the side of the British, we're going to give you some land and da-da-da, all that, whatever. And obviously they gave the worst of the worst, as they always do. But somehow community happened. Like, black folks ended up making settlements and making mm-hmm. community out of nothing. And again, there was interrelation with Mi'kmaq people on that survival. Like, how are we going to survive against this common oppressor? And now we have situations, obviously, where communities are so segregated, where you could be Afro-Indigenous, Mi'kmaq and Black, and when you're on Mi'kmaq territory, so you're in particularly, like, reserve community, you're Mi'kmaq. But as soon as you go into Yarmouth or Dartmouth or Weymouth or Digby, you're black. So it's just like, you know, there's a lot of work to be done around how are we recentering indigeneity? How are we decentering whiteness? Why are we acting like white folks? And why are we so quick to accept white people into our communities but shun black folks and Afro-Indigenous folks? Yeah.
I 100% agree. 100%. Especially what you were saying. I'm going to actually have to call out Haudenosaunee folks right now.
Oh, Lord.
Honestly, the people that I have faced the most violence and anti-blackness from have been Haudenosaunee folks.
Mm.
When I wrote that piece about Kent Monkman and his anti-black art, and I had mentioned the fact that Haudenosaunee folks had owned slaves...
Yes, I remember
this. The emails I was getting, the messages I was getting. I had Haudenosaunee folks sending me messages being like, well, Joseph Brandt, you know, referred to his slave as family. So it wasn't that bad.
Don't get
you
me
know,
started.
I, like, the amount of folks that literally came for me, there was a piece that was written about, you know, Anishinaabe changing the way we refer to black folks in the language. I had mentioned for a split, it was one little line that I said, you know, Haudenosaunee folks are also looking at this because it was a conversation that I was having with Haudenosaunee friends.
Yeah.
Haudenosaunee people had messaged the reporter to the point that they took the line out of the article.
Wow.
It was just like...
Like that.
And yeah, it was like that. And I was like... Like I'm not Haudenosaunee. I'm not going to sit here and say that I know close to anything about Haudenosaunee culture. I have luckily been accepted into small parts of community by Haudenosaunee folks. I dated a Haudenosaunee man for 6 years.
Okay.
And so I've been around the community enough to experience anti-blackness. Yeah. And, you know, and so I've had conversations with friends who grew up on the res in Six Nations or in Ganawage. You know, we've had conversations about anti-blackness. And so for me, it was wild that I was like having all these really dope conversations with Haudenosaunee folks that were like, yeah, we're not about this. We're addressing it in our communities. And then it was like when I left those bubbles, all of a sudden I was getting attacked and I was so confused because I was like, I have felt so welcomed by Haudenosaunee folks, like cared for and loved and taken in. And then it was like, once I left that bubble, I was like, oh, it's an anti-black world out here. You and know, so I was like really confused.
It's, you know, again, that also speaks to the fact that, you know, clearly we're not homogeneous, even within our nationhood. And, you know, even within Haudenosaunee, we're talking about different factions as well, right? Like within the Six Nations, it's very different. You know, chilling with Oneida folks is a different experience than chilling with Ganyangahaga folks or Mohawk folks. It's a different energy. And then depending, like, geography, like, where are you doing the chilling? But I agree with you. I think that... and this is something that I mentioned the other day on a panel. We also need to look at, you know, as Indigenous folks, some of our quote-unquote traditional teachings, you know, are these traditional teachings really our teachings? Or are there actual white supremacist, patriarchal, colonial frameworks interwoven in there, and you are projecting that and you're not even realizing it, which is kind of... we're talking about Haudenosaunee, but also I'm going to switch now to Anishinaabe folks and the medicine wheel. And how many times I've had the medicine wheel used against me as a tool of anti-blackness. Oh, my God. Oh my
when they use it, when they say the black represents black people, first of all, I just want to, as an Anishinaabe person, I just want to make something very clear. The medicine wheel that we see today and the description around race is something that was created within the prison system to help create an understanding of relationship between Indigenous people in the prison system and others. And so that's where we get the race definition behind it. That is not a traditional teaching. This idea that if you are black, then you must be Bear Clan because bears and the black on the medicine. Like, none of that right. is traditional teachings. Now, is it something that's been incorporated into teachings? Yes, it is. Yeah. I've had elders say it constantly. And there's, like, some very xenophobic, like, understandings behind, you know, the yellow in the medicine wheel is for the Asian community, and it's because they're inquisitive. Like,
yeah,
real, there's a yeah, lot of problems so with that. There's a lot yeah. of problems with that. And so, like, for folks that are listening, I just want to say, you know, that the medicine wheel does not represent race. That is something that was used in the prison system that has been co-opted and now used in a broader sense. And also, like, this is just my little rant. Can we stop using the medicine wheel as a pan-Indigenous identifier for First Nations?
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Not everyone uses the medicine wheel. Not everyone uses that as teachings. I think it's really weird that we continue to pan-Indigenize the medicine wheel. Also, another slight little rant, pan-Indigenizing Turtle Island. Not every Indigenous these territories refer to these lands as Turtle Island. Not all of them have the same creation stories. And so very careful when I'm saying Turtle Island, because I'll usually be like, oh, Canada or Turtle Island as Anishinaabe and other nations refer to. Because I realized that even the way I was talking about my relationship to the land was very Anishinaabe centered. And I was like, oh, wait, other folks don't believe that.
Yeah,
really reevaluate even the way I was like erasing other nations and how I talked.
Good point. Yep.
Yo, so I think so many really good points. For me, when it comes to being able to just understand and really cope with the kind of widespread anti-blackness slash whether it be negrophobia, negrophilia, or the kind of picking and choosing what parts of our culture of people like about specifically black people, whether they be any kind of non-black person, I think it's how when unfortunately what colonization has done to people who were coded as black in terms of the kind of collective unconsciousness or the kind of worth that people have for black people, it's something that has its roots in global slave trade. And, you know, obviously those kinds of slave codes, those kinds of socializations of like criminalizing blackness and black people have crossed over into, you know, our everyday culture, our thought pattern, how we relate to one another. And it sort of explains to me what I was talking about in terms of like cultural appropriation, why people can pick apart pretty much any aspect of black culture, but they'll be very hesitant to wear any garments or practice any sort of sacred kind of teachings or practices without cultural exchange, at least within people of color community, but will be very quick to pull from in any case, I think that, this speaks to the kind of not only white entitlement, but anti-black entitlement that people have to our cultures. And I think the people who do it right are the people who acknowledge, where these kinds of things came from. And also with that kind of real cultural exchange where they are speaking up for black people or are acknowledging anti-blackness in their communities. It gets really, really tiring to consistently see that day and night, night and day, colonization has formulated blackness to be commodifiable. no matter where and what time. And that's something that I, you know, wrestle with. But I think with past, you know, back to our past kinship alliances where enslaved Africans, you know, they colluded with indigenous peoples of these lands to then, you know, revolt against slave owners and plantations to then create community together. I think like that really needs to be highlighted. And I think we really need to highlight, like we've been saying, our common enemies in these structures of power, because like, you know, like I'm often the odd person out in terms of conversation regarding like voting and voting suppression and opting into the state apparatus to make change. Like, I'm really not trying to see a black trans president or a black or native, you know, a native senator. Exactly. Like, these are the colonized, you know, institutions that
someone had to say it
to be assimilated into. It's been a hard few weeks, I'm sure for y'all too, because the consistent kind of voting has become this other kind of form of domination that's kind of like thrown at us consistently, whether it be the people that are online or companies. It's like, what? Like, I don't need to talk about voting because Instagram and social media and like, you know, like your email is telling you to vote. Like, why are we having these conversations on colonial strategies of decision making? Why do we have to celebrate, you know, this new presidency? And that's the other, you know, like, I like what you said about homogeneity of like black and indigenous voices. Like, obviously not all black people or indigenous people agree when it comes to, you know, neo-colonial strategies that keep recreating themselves through coercion. But we should still be able to talk about it in real ways that aren't consistently gaslighting people who don't have whose worldviews aren't affirmed by these colonial institutions of power.
1,000%. Every time people look at me when I'm like, oh, I don't vote. Right. And then they look at me and they're like, what do you mean you don't vote? Your ancestors fought. Well, first of all, my black ancestors are from the Caribbean. So they, you know, they didn't fight on these lands to vote. Second of all, like, they voted for what they needed they fought for what they needed at the time. And at the time, voting is what they needed. That doesn't mean that's what we need right now.
Right.
Just because and I think that's something that's important to remember, that what our ancestors fought for, yes, obviously they were thinking about generations to come, but they were also thinking about what folks needed at that time. And yes, when black folks got the right to vote, when we think about the Reconstruction era in the United States, there was more black people elected than ever before, right? Like, we saw that. And then we also saw the Democrats when they were, I mean, they're still white supremacists, but when they were really white supremacists, we saw them overthrow governments throughout the states to make sure that there was whites only, right? And so I've thought about it often. I'm like, when we have black and indigenous elected officials, do the lives of their black and indigenous constituents actually change? Like what is the change for them? And I think often, like, as someone who lives in Ontario, who has grown up in Toronto, and Toronto's a like very black city, you know, and Ontario has some black MPPs, which are, you know, our municipal provincial politicians. I'm sure there's someone in a civics class that knows what MPP stands for. But when it comes to that, I don't remember my life. Like, I remember Toronto, we had a mayor whose wife was Trini, and she was black, and I was like, well, my life has not changed. Like, being married to a black woman and loving black people, it did not change. Yeah. You know, when Rob Ford was mayor of Toronto, for American folks, Rob Ford was the mayor who was doing crack. When we had that mayor for Toronto, he talked all the time about how he loved black people. He even threw on a Jamaican accent. Yep. Nothing changed for me as a black person. And then when I think about, you know, and it's not to say the work of elected black officials or indigenous officials, it's not to say that the work they do isn't important. Of course it's important. I really believe in having people on the inside and on the outside. Yeah. But I think oftentimes about the system and how much of themselves they have to compromise. Mm-hmm. How much they have to give up on. When I think of like people like Barack Obama, he deported more black people than any sitting president ever. Let's talk about it, right? Mm-hmm. Like, let's talk about what that means. Even if we were to get an Indigenous prime minister, mm-hmm. right? Indigenous people in Canada still only make up 3% of the population. Yep. It would be very naive to think that what we want would get done. It's just not, it's not going to happen when you still have the Conservative Party, right? Or the Republicans in the United States. Like, at the end of the day,
right.
to replace, you'd have to replace every single person in Parliament or in Congress with black and indigenous people. And you have to replace them with the black and indigenous people who believe in what you believe in, right? Because we all recognize that not all skin folk are kinfolk. We have to recognize that not everyone, we are not a monolith. Black folks, indigenous folk, we believe different things. So you would have to get people in that align with your belief system, right? About an equitable framework that aren't capitalistic. And then you'd have to make sure that everyone in the country also supports this. And so it's like every time I hear this thing of like, we have to vote because what we say matters, and we have to get black and indigenous people into Parliament or into Congress and all of these things. Mm-hmm. I'm like, I would love to believe that that would work. But something that I've realized 500 years later, we've just changed the way in which we enslave black indigenous people. Mm-hmm. It just looks different. With mass incarceration, right?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. For me, it's like, I want to see more than just black folks in positions of power, right? A rich black person is still a capitalist. Yeah, they're still functioning with capitalism. A rich indigenous person is still functioning within capitalism. That having a rich indigenous person as a CEO or whatever is not going to change the lives of poor indigenous people. It's not going to change the lives of folks on the res, right? We've realized that. You see that in communities where there's oil and there's an influx of money in those communities, and how that actually negatively affects communities. There's higher rates of suicide. There's higher rates of addiction. There's higher rates of homelessness. Like, having money on the res does not mean a better life for folks on the res.
Absolutely.
So, when I think of things that we need on the res, it's access to clean drinking water. It's access to proper housing. And yes, technically money is what would get that to happen, but it also could get done without the money. Like, we need the supplies. Give us the housing supplies. We've got engineers. We've got plumbers, right? We've got people who know how to do this work. If you give us the supplies, trust me, we'll get it done. But we live in a capitalistic society where folks aren't willing to do it unless they're getting paid. Because you can't survive.
Exactly. And I think, again, this comes back to the fact that we are just so, we are still in a colonial project. A colonized mindset has us so removed from what it means to be in relation to the land and to ourselves. And it's, you know, more power, you know, creates more corruption at the end of the day. And as you mentioned, like, when you, I mean, not even going beyond, you know, federal governments or, you know, presidents or prime ministers, but the band councils, the tribal councils, these are systems that were set up essentially to subjugate.
So liberal.
the general populations, right? In that sense, right? Mm-hmm. So it's like, I think that, again, I'm at the, like, really, we need to burn all of this down. And when we think about what was it before this? Like, how were we governing, quote unquote, ourselves before we this imposition, before white folks actually took what we were doing here as indigenous peoples? Are you know, they often say, what is the origin of quote-unquote democracy? And the fact that they bastardized it and turned it into this just really messed up version of something that we centered elders, we centered children, we centered the matrilinear ways of knowing and being. And when they got here and they saw that, they were like, oh, we centered, you know, our gender fluidity. They saw this and they were like, what the hell is this? This is just like, this scared the hell out of them. They were like, nah, son, we gotta snuff this out. And they flipped it into a patriarchy, into a system that is just so stifling to our ability to actually live, to be, to breathe, like literally. And so when we're talking about power, it's like, how do we use our power? You know, what is our belief when it comes to power? You know, is our belief that power is finite, that the goal is to hoard everything and to use force and coercion and domination, you know, and to motivate people to buy into that power through fear? That's the system that we're under. And we're just going to have, you know, talking heads, you know, that may look like us, but are in that colonial mindset representing us. And that's the scary thing about, yes, the political, the whole political systems are part of the white supremacist agenda. And we have to start looking at operating outside of that. You can still be politically engaged. Our people have always had a sense of governance. You can have a sense of governance without being part of the government.
Truly. Truly.
Let's go.
I mean, so I feel like I really want to let other listeners know that Black people, Afro-Indigenous people, are gendered and racialized in specific ways that really kind of fortify this kind of idea that, like, Black or Afro-Indigenous people can't fit into specific gender norms that have been you know, kind of like imposed on Indigenous communities throughout the world. Today is Trans Day of Remembrance Resilience. I am reminded consistently as like an Afro-Indigenous trans woman that, like, you know, it's like it's really difficult to exist in all of these spaces for specifically for Black trans women when like I had it in my head. I had a terrible experience in organizing with the Black Lives Matter TM network. Just saying that, like, they did really no work in trying to educate people on gender issues, educate other Black folks on gender issues. So the kind of homophobia, transphobia that many Black people experience kind of, like, pushed us out of these organizing circles. So there's quite a turnaround when it comes to Black Lives Matter TM, trademark. But I think that what I was hoping was that because, oh, look at, like, there's, like, you know, indigenous communities also that I have been organizing with and getting more involved with, I think that they have a better understanding of gender from a non-colonial standpoint, and acknowledging that, like, you know, we as indigenous people have ties to customs and culture that expands the binary, or it goes past and traverses these kind of binary norms that have been posed on us by colonization. Whereas Black people, you know, don't really commute. The Black community doesn't really have that as, like, a whole. And I want the, I want these, like, conversations to be had between Black people, indigenous people, Afro-Indigenous people. I think they're really, really important. Mm-hmm. I think Black people have a lot to teach to Indigenous people, and Indigenous people have a lot to teach to Black people, because we've done that before, but also, like, you know, the fucking world is, you know, is ending. And
yes.
It's like a good thing and a bad thing. It's like, I, you know, it's like, yes, encouraging the end of industrial civilization to bring on, like, an era that isn't, that has a real connection and relationship with the land and mm-hmm. quote unquote non-human beings, and something, you know, that actually changes and transforms our social relationships to one another. Because, like, I think part of what I feel like a lot of indigenous people of these lands don't understand is that globally people experience anti-indigeneity, and there's people, for whatever reason, that define indigeneity with, you know, the kind of indigeneity that we see out here, typically, you know, like brown skin and long hair and straight hair, you know, it's like, if there's, like, so many ways to be indigenous in similar ways, there's so many ways to phenotypically, at least, to be indigenous, and to be Black, to be honest.
Yeah.
It's just that what fucks me up is that for Black people, because of anti-Blackness, a lot of our phenotypes, like our hair or our skin color, has been demonized or bastardized or seen as less than human. Whereas, you know, that kind of rationalizing people's hatred for us hasn't happened for other ethnicities or indigenous folks in the same kinds of ways, where it's like, you know, like, it does something to people to be seen as less valuable or seen as ugly because of the texture of their hair, or because of, you know, them having full features. You know, it's it does something psychologically to people, and this is why so many Black feminists were saying, you know, in the 60s, 70s, like, we have to actually love ourselves. Like, there needs to be an era of self-love for us to matter, because we're consistently being told by not just white people, but also non-Black people, that we are not beautiful, that we're commodifiable, that we're not seen as, like, people with agency and personhood. So that, I think that's important. These kinds of, I think cultural exchanges need to happen way more than they're happening now. And in consensual ways, because, you know, how people are sharing stuff on Instagram, and, like, you know, people pick apart and, like, steal culture through that way. So I would hope that people are more careful in like who they're sharing space with, mm-hmm. but please mm-hmm. do that, because it saddens me to see that, like, no, there aren't any Black folks that I know that don't have ties to land or Indigenous, you know, relatives who don't know how to cope with the struggles of their lives or don't have the same kinds of spiritual faculties as Indigenous people, where Indigenous people, it is like we have to name that is a privilege to know your nation. It is mm-hmm. a privilege mm-hmm. to know like what specific lands you come from, because when we're mm-hmm. talking about honoring the land and land back and getting back to the land, like these can be anti-Black sentiments for people, for a captive population that has literally yeah. been raped into being. Like, like a lot of Black people have literally not consensually consented into existing because of slavery. And yes. I would hope that like things like sweat ceremony can be shared to these descendants rather than the fucking military. The military is now literally teaching or giving, performing sweat for military people who have PTSD and giving them sweat ceremony. How did they learn this?
Yep.
This wasn't mm-hmm. just something that what like it. It's an exchange. This a cultural exchange actually happened. So some liberal neo-colonial ass native had to be like, yeah, I'll give you all our you know ability to heal, you know, heal right now. Like, sure, I think that it's like, nah, like,
no.
Why not exchange with people who are a captive population, who are,
yeah,
you know.
You know how often I have tried in the work that I do in community, especially around, you know, getting access for urban youth, you know, mm-hmm. Black urban youth, Afro-Indigenous urban youth. I mean, I'm an urban NDN. I mean, as much as I do still have ties to, you know, homelands and traditional territories because of my family, I'm an urban NDN. Like, I'm up in this urban Scarborough, yeah. yo, like, mm-hmm. you know, but I'm just saying, like, so trying to coordinate with Indigenous folks that I actually do have relationship with to say, you know, wouldn't it be cool if we could bring some urban youth, you know, some Black and Afro-Indigenous youth out, you know, onto the land to do yes. sweat, to get some teachings, to learn about, you know, tracking and hunting and you know, all of these things, right? Mm-hmm. And you do get some resistance there, where it's just mm-hmm. like there's all these so-called, you know, red tapes and black tapes and gray tapes or whatever color tape it is to be able to make it happen. But again, when you're talking about, yeah, we'll do it for, you know, the military, or we'll right. do it for, you know, police officers or prison workers, yeah. Because they're getting money. You know, I'm just like, where is your priorities? How are you calling yourself an Indigenous person that is about community and about the land, and you're doing this? Mm-hmm. There's something not right here. And we are in the ends of days, which means we mm-hmm. need to be thinking about the next generation and the generations to come. We need to be thinking about food sovereignty. We need to be thinking about Black farmers and how our farmlands as Black people. And I know my descendants and my not even my descendants, like my grandparents and their lands that they farmed on in what is now known as Nova Scotia. And what does that mean in relationship to Indigenous community? We have every mm-hmm. right also be able to sustain ourselves on right. these lands where we were literally beaten and bludgeoned to make this happen in a colonial mm-hmm. context. Anyways, that's my
1,000%.
Yeah. Y'all are great.
You all are great.
Honestly, I'm just like, damn, everyone's just dropping knowledge. I'm just here, like, living for everything that's been said.
I know. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. Hey, everyone, I'm back. And, oh, my fucking God, y'all are, like, so incredible. Like, I'm going to have to listen to this over again and just, like, make sure I catch every little bit because, wow, that was just, like, so amazing. And I hope it felt really good to just freely converse amongst each other about really all this. Yay! Oh,
yeah, good medicine. Good medicine.
Yeah,
good. Good, good. Well, I don't want to necessarily end there because one thing that, you know, I think would be really good to talk about to a wide audience is how, like, since we're talking about, we've talked about, or we, as in, like, y'all have talked about liberalism and the death that liberalism brings to our movements and our struggles and our resistance. And it just really, like, brings to question, like, how do we address liberals as indigenous radicals? Like, we're indigenous action. We believe in direct action and intervention and antagonization of anything that would perpetuate white settler domination and control. And so when we see things like we saw during the George Floyd uprisings of liberals kneeling with cops and wanting reform instead of like total abolishment, like how can we name instances of that happening without perpetuating anti-blackness? Because, you know, as we said in the beginning of this broadcast, we always like kind of exist in these silos. And sometimes this is when I kind of am like, gosh, identity politics is really kind of like putting us between a rock and a hard place on some of these things, you know, from liberalism to like being like a black liberal or being an indigenous liberal. And then like we want to build that solidarity. So what can we do as radicals when we see liberalism happening across our and within our communities?
Yeah, I think that's really hard, honestly. When I think about like folks who support the police or the military who are like black, indigenous or indigenous cities, territories, I'm always like, for many of us, the military or the police force has not only been obviously an oppressor, but it's been how we've made it out of poverty, made it out of suffering, made it out of class into upper classes, right? When we think about it, is the military and the police force have represented an opportunity to take back power in a very colonial way, but to take back power regardless. And especially when you think about how hard black and indigenous folks had to fight to even get into the police force, right? And oftentimes when I hear like black or indigenous youth talk about why they want to be police or they want to be in the military, it's because they're like, I want to be the better, right? It's the same with like the political system. It's like, I want to get in to be the change. I want to be the person. I want to be that police officer that's coming when black people are calling. I want to be that police officer that's arriving, or that firefighter that's arriving when indigenous children are dying in a house, right? Like that is a lot of the times the reason why black and indigenous folks end up in the police force or end up in the military, is because it's seen as an avenue out, but also as an avenue to help for a lot of them, right? They're like, I will be the change. The reality is because in the past, we haven't been as honest about what these systems are. And once again, like politics, you go in and you have to compromise your morals, right? Mm. There's a system that's already been established. I'm someone who does not believe in decolonizing academia or decolonize. Like, we've, for some reason, been in this, like, hyperdrive to decolonize for white folks. Like, we're like, I'm going to decolonize this institution. Well, the institution is inherently anti-black and anti-indigenous, right, and transphobic and homophobic. It's all of these things, right? And for me, it's like, you can't decolonize something that's at its core never been decolonial. right? Yeah. You can decolonize community, you can decolonize language, you can decolonize gender, you can decolonize things that were never colonial to begin with, but you can't decolonize a space that's in its inherent bones, in its roots, are colonial. Yeah, and so really. I think that's where we're missing that disconnect, right? Like a lot of folks believe working within the system can get us the change that we need. A lot of folks believe that. That is something that a lot of folks inherently keep, right? This idea that well, if we just work within the system, then we can change the system. Right. And it's because I would say since the like 50s and onwards is that we've really bought into that idea that if we just get in, if we just get a seat at the table, pardon my French, but I fucking hate that.
Right.
We need a seat at the table. I don't want a seat at the table. I don't want to be at a crumbling table. I don't want the table at all. I don't want a chair. Don't give me a stool. Don't even put me at the kiddie table. I don't want the table. And so, but that's been the narrative that we've pushed, right? We just need a seat at the table.
Yeah.
And so I think that's where we have that disconnect with liberals. It's not that they don't believe in the change that, you know, we are all hoping for, which is at the end of the day, it's equity for all, right? Liberals still believe in that. Some, I should say. Some liberals still believe in that equity for all. The problem is they've bought into this narrative that has been given to us by white supremacists. Like, if you just work hard, if you just get here, if you just get in, you can. And we've also believed in that you are the change. And it's not to say you aren't the change, right? But we've bought into that. I did it too. My first year of university, I ran for anti-racism commissioner. I was like, I'm going to end racism at Trent University.
Why?
Obviously, I did not. But you believe it, right? You buy into it. You're like, I'm the change. What do you mean? I'm the change.
Yeah, exactly.
And you end up burning yourself out. And I think that's how a lot of us started out liberal. We all started out like, I am the change. And then you realize I'm just a part of the change. Community is the change.
Yeah.
Right? But most of us start out liberal. And then we go through the system, we get burned out, and we realize this ain't it, sis, or this ain't it, Sib. And so, I think a lot of liberals are still in the, you know, we're trying to figure out. They'll get to the it ain't it, Sib. But, like, a lot of them right now are unfortunately lost in the sauce, as they say.
And I think it's also, like, the fear, right? Like, we're also conditioned to believe that this is the only way. That, you know, if you are going to make a difference, you have to do it this way. And there are only these opportunities, as opposed to thinking about in a more divergent kind of way. It's just like, well, what's outside of this? What can we reimagine as an actual sustainable, possible abolitionist reality that actually not only makes change, but it does it in a way where we really are fully embracing, you know, solidarity and inclusivity and equity and justice and liberation. These are not just hashtags anymore, but they're actually like real femifested realities. And it's so the one thing is we have to start offering. I can only speak for myself. I mean, I'm like in my auntie years now. So as coming into my auntie years, it's like I need to start offering young people, the next generation, and seeding for my descendants something outside of this. Let's screw this. Let's do something else and let other people see that and be like, what's going on over here? God damn it. Maybe that's where it's at. And you'll see. That's what I think has to happen. So for me, like, being the change that you want to see is literally about metamorphosis. It's literally about, you know, being a shapeshifter. And that's part of our culture. And I'm shapeshifting right now. I don't give a damn about any of this. I'm just really about what can I do outside of all this to give some new openings. Let's just crack it wide open. You know, we come from people who were already like, you know, could read the stars and were already like levitating their spirits before the Europeans got here. We have the capacity to do anything. So let's do it, you know? And I don't mean like, let's do it Nike. I mean like, let's really do it.
Right, yeah. I think there's, when it comes to the, some of what we're discussing regarding liberals and radicals and like just the different kinds of isms and ideologies and underpinning logics, we're not arguing in the same with the same framework or lenses. So I find it really, really fascinating that I will literally like hit all of the points, like for voting, for example, how ethically it's terrible, strategically it's terrible, you know, like there's so many points I will hit in criticizing in you know the critique of voting, but they'll go back to one that I had named, where like I really think it's misunderstanding. And like, yeah, like we were saying before, or Shanice was acknowledging that like a lot of us were like, I did at some point think this way. I didn't think in terms of power or institutional power. I thought in terms of my, like our individual decisions or, you know, individual blame. And I really didn't see structural power in the same ways that I see it now. So I agree with you all that like it takes this kind of evolution or like maybe de-evolution into thinking in these kinds of anti-colonial ways that really allow us to like have these conversations. Like it's hard with liberals because, like I was saying before, like they have a whole state institution and system that provides them and reaffirms their underpinning logics and their reason. Whereas indigenous philosophies, particularly anti-authoritarian or anarchist ideologies or philosophies, they don't have those kinds of faculties to back them up. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So like our worldviews are even marginalized, and who to liberals, it's like, well, who are you to even say anything when like there's structurally nothing that support can sustain or legitimize your argument. And I think that's where the disconnect is with liberals and trying to understand where they're coming from as somebody who was one and is now not. I think they're like, you know, I don't know if they're like mad that they're not there and they don't get it yet, or but there's like an intense kind of backlash that we often see when we're criticizing the things that they seem to be complicit in, whether it's voting or electoral reform. It's like, you know, at some point we have to sit down and have real conversations about like, well, you know, we can't build coalition with people who are trying to sustain or give energy, legitimacy, and power to what we're actually trying to destroy. Like it's not going to happen. So like, yeah, not everybody's going to be on the same page. I think it does, you know, I think a lot of people this year have specifically been radicalized because, you know, they were like, okay, sure, I haven't been, I've been home all day for months on end, you know, for a while, because of COVID. Oh, you know, everybody's out on the streets, let me hit the streets. And then, you know, they're like, you know, we're peaceful. And then the police brutalize them. That's a good way to become radicalized and understanding that, wow, like, people on the streets are right. The police aren't doing the things that the mainstream Hollywood industrial complex and mainstream media are, you know, selling us. They're not helping us, and they're not, you know, there are just these armed, you know, men who are just actually do want to attack people, actually opt into these institutions because they know they have the ability to just like attack people willy-nilly. And I've engaged with liberals significantly less than I have in the past. In the past, when I first became radicalized, it was always attempting to convince them, but I've come to realize that, like, well, it's really hard to do that when we're literally not on the same page, or we're literally not thinking using the same logic or lenses and have the same worldviews. It's impossible mm-hmm. for them to come to an understanding right now. Whereas mm-hmm. like they might feel foolish, you know, in the future when they look back to some of the things and reasonings that they were using. I think for when it comes to identity politics, you know, it's kind of like there's this misunderstanding of like what it actually is. I think identity politics in terms of like the Kambahi River Collective, collective of like Black feminist women who were trying to talk about intersectionality in a way that criticized the kind of whiteness mm-hmm. of organizing, but also the patriarchy of organizing communities, and you know, came to an understanding through practice that like, yo, our identities being Black women, lesbians, is like, you know, we experience all of these things at once. And I think there can be, or has often been, this kind of, yeah, liberal co-optation of these identities to meet the needs of colonial coercive power. And I don't mm-hmm. think that's ever going to stop. I just think we have to be prepared for it. You know, like, so I think, yeah, I was talking to other people in Indigenous Action Network about how, you know, they're handling you know, how to engage with like Black Lives Matter, for example, because mm-hmm. unfortunately Black Lives Matter is very liberal, and they, you know, use all this like quote unquote radical rhetoric, but they do liberal things. Mm-hmm. And I think it's for them to be like, well, you criticizing us as anti-Black, you not allowing Black and Indigenous people to celebrate the win of Biden and Harris is anti-Black and anti-Indigenous. Mm. Like that's a misuse of you know, understanding. And there's nuance to it. There's a lot of nuanced arguments considering, yeah, like I don't feel good about like a white woman being like particularly condescending to Black people who might not have been radicalized or Black people who aren't there yet. And like,
right.
Yeah,
you know, but there's another thing of like, you know, there's frustration, you know, there's frustration for me specifically around knowing that like, your vote is sustaining and legitimizing colonization. That's frustrating right. to me. So I might not be in the best of moods when I'm delivering, you know, critiques, because every 4 years I have to do this where like, mm-hmm. if I'm not completely off of social media or not just like, you know, when election time comes around, I'm gonna lose a lot of friends. I'm gonna stop like, you know, there's like, you know, people that I know who are like, yo, if you don't vote this year, unfollow me, delete me, and then I turn around and I'm like, bye boo, like, I don't care. Like, yeah, oh, I'm the person that you're talking about, and like, you're out here, you know, demeaning people who don't vote, but also people who can't vote, people who like, it's really upsetting. So I think all I have to do to confront that kind of liberalism, the liberal argument of, oh, you're not you're being anti-black by, you know, critiquing liberals who vote, black liberals who vote or whatever. My argument to that is like, well, it isn't there. I think there needs to be a little bit more depth to their politics and analyzing like why they need to vote, why they need to opt into colonial structures to survive. Because explaining it as a means of like leveraging some sort of resources is like, oh, in understanding that it's a coercive kind of engagement is one thing, but then completely having an ahistorical viewpoint of opting into this, you know, these structures is another thing.
Absolutely. But, and I just to add like a Canadian, what is now Canada context, when we think about our current prime minister and the fact that how many Indigenous folks, you know, initially, you know, voted for him because
the sleeping giant.
Yeah,
we were called the sleeping giant.
Yeah, absolutely. The promises to do something different than what we had seen under Stephen Harper, and simply, you know, quote unquote, bring us to the table. You know, to really deal with the water situation in our communities, and it has not been done yet. And he's on his second term. We think about how many black folks voted in Trudeau because, you know, there is this sentiment that because he is the son of Pierre Elliott Trudeau, and that connection with, you know, immigration and multiculturalism and all of that stuff, you know, that happened, there's almost like, you know, people feel indebted, you know, to voting for this guy. And so we did, and where has it gotten us as black
people? Absolutely nowhere. Absolutely nowhere. Trudeau is spending millions of dollars fighting Indigenous organizations from providing adequate care for Indigenous youth in care. Justin Trudeau, yes, the blackface. Let's talk about the blackface.
Yeah, the blackface for black people.
Yeah, but also the fact that when we think about immigration and we think about all the black immigrants from the Caribbean that were brought here in the 70s, 60s and 80s by his father, and the amount of black folks that are brought here now, the fact that we're used as migrant workers on farms, paid little to farm on these lands, the fact the Canadian government was trying to deport a Jamaican man who was in a coma because he fell from a tree while farming, and they were trying to deport him while he was in the coma.
Exactly.
Listen, Canada's really pushed as this beautiful place for black and Indigenous people.
It's a lie.
The reality is, it's a full lie. Honestly, full lie. We are, like, Canada is racist by denial. We are racist in our denial of racism. And so, Canada's not the rainbow place everyone likes to think of. Even when we're talking about trans issues, trans women that are murdered, we like to very much shy away from the harm that's done on these lands towards black and Indigenous folks and queer folks. And that is something that, you know, Canada's done a great job at hiding.
Exactly.
Yeah, definitely. It almost
seems like, you know, I feel like y'all probably gotten this question a lot over the last 8-9 months. But, like, when people ask for, like, a clear answer to, like, you know, how do I confront liberalism, and just, like, hearing how, like, complex and multi-layered everything is, there is really no, like, clear way, because it's just, like, confusing. And, like I said, like, when I posed the question, I was like, you know, how do we intervene? How do we, like, act directly into the witnessing of everything that y'all just talked about? It's just, there's almost seems like there's no clear answer then, other than to, like, just shut shit down and make sure that people are a part of it to witness it for themselves, so that they can for themselves believe in the liberation of confrontation, and the confrontation that happens directly with police, the confrontation that happens directly with our transphobic relatives, or whatever it may be. And otherwise, I don't know, you know, I really don't know how to answer that question with a clear, concise, like, boxed in, nicely packaged answer. Yeah, so I really appreciate everyone's perspectives on that. And then, just to kind of, like, wrap up, did anyone have any final things they really wanted to say? I have some things that I want to go back over, just, like, really briefly, as the, you know, non-Black Indigenous person here, that I hear you saying that we... And like, in my head, I'm like, okay, that is something that, like, I need to say and reiterate out loud, so that it's taken away as, like, a clear message that there's some shit that we should really stop doing. But before I do that, yeah, was there anything, any last minute closing thoughts that y'all wanted to share?
I think for me, the thing that I want to share most is that Black people are Indigenous people, and their indigeneity is not based on their relationship to Indigenous people to these territories. Black folks are Indigenous folks by indigeneity, by way of Africa. Black folks who are on these lands are Indigenous folks displaced. And I think that's one thing that I want to leave with folks, is that Black indigeneity is not based on relationship to Indigenous people to these lands. There are Afro-Indigenous folks who are Afro-Indigenous simply because they are from the continent, simply because they are descendants of slaves, of Indigenous people displaced, and that you can't quantify their indigeneity based on their relationship to you if you're an Indigenous person to these territories.
Damn! Hell yeah.
Drop it. Yes. I think the last thing I want to just say is really actually directed towards, like, my Afro-Indigenous kin out there. You know, I've been, since the lockdown, I've been doing so many panels, so many, you know, speaking engagements, and just, like, really saying that, you know, I have so much love, like, Gona Lunkwa, for all of us. And just remember, like, we have lots of medicine to offer, in this time of, like, I guess, mm-hmm. abolition and recentering, you know, ourselves in these narratives and moving away from, you know, the colonial mindsets. And just know that, you know, you, all of you, every aspect of who you are, is very, very valid, is very beautiful, is part and parcel of a revolution that started way before you came into this world in the form that you're in now. And, you know, I see you, I love you, and we have so much to offer, not just to Indigenous kin, not just to POC folks, but to ourselves. Mm-hmm. And I really want us to continue to build on our kinship, do not lose sight of that, because there is a special magic there and a special medicine that we all need and we all deserve. Go no lunkwa. I love you. Thank you. Nyao goa.
Jimmy Gwitch.
Yeah, I guess for me, I want to say that if you are going to organize like a panel or conversation on the subject of anti-blackness, make sure you check in with the one or two black people, or however many black people in the space, on whether or not they're going to actually have that conversation and hold other people's like experiences, or hold other people's just like anti-black thoughts. Cause I've definitely, been expected to have conversation or even facilitate conversations on anti-blackness without being checked in about like whether or not I wanted to participate in that facilitation or holding other people's like talking conversations about like, oh, how they're not black, but they're a little bit darker skin, and how people in their family used to call them like negrito or whatever. And like, you know, it's like, but you're not black, so you can't like compare the things. And also, yeah, like, you know, I agree with what other folks have been saying, like 1000%, like our ancestors definitely had a strategy, and they strategically put us here to, you know, to fuck shit up and to dismantle this shit finally. And I think it's really beautiful how like we're having these conversations, like trans women, Afro-Indigenous people are making art and having conversations with one another, and you know, time stamping these things, and like that, you know, it's been a while. It's a wild time, because some of these things, you know, yeah, it's replenishing those histories, and it's coming back. Thank you all so much. Please, I'll get your all's information from Bon.
Yes.
I want to connect.
Oh my god, y'all are just so incredible, and I'm just so grateful to have been able to witness y'all circle today. And Shanice, like, I really love what you said about how we kind of forgot our ways of welcoming and like nurturing new people, and that installation of fear and being suspect of everything and guarded is like, it's so fucked up to feel like that all the time, to just have that hate or have that like resistance to love, is really hard to carry in this world. And it's definitely like a symptom of genocide and ecocide. And so just to name that out loud, I think is so important, so that we don't forget our nurturing and welcoming ways. And then I also just wanted to reiterate how everyone really needs to recognize, like Edsy said, the unique relationships that Black people held in kinship with this so-called Turtle Island. I might even start saying that now, because Turtle Island is such a pan-Indigenous thing, and now it's like, I need to say, like, how we say so-called America, it's like, now I need to say so-called Turtle Island.
Do it.
But anyway, like just recognizing that unique relationship with so-called Turtle Island, with like our Indigenous cottons and herbs and and foods and stuff. And so when we say Indigenous means being of the land, Black people are of the land in a way that recognizes their displacement. And so when people say that Black people shouldn't be included or uplifted over another freaking like cishet male indigenous dude in indigenous spaces. Like, that's just like so whack, and I'm like fucking tired of it. Like, yeah. So tired of seeing that we would do that, and how how like we really need to be talking about Black people when we talk about land back and land acknowledgement. And that kind of came out weird. Like I said, we need to talk about Black people, but we need to have Black people and their experiences centered and uplifted in conversations mm-hmm. about land back. And lastly, Malaika, I just wanted to reiterate how they said that Indigenous communities are real quick to like dismiss the lives of their very own Black relations, and over we have like a huge responsibility to take way better care of our Black kin, and you know, we are the caretakers and we're supposed to care, and so we can't forget that colonialism is really what taught us to hate each other. Mm-hmm. And it taught mm-hmm. us to favor them instead.
Exactly.
And it's like, fuck that. Like, fuck that. That's over. That's just like a mechanism of control that still exists today through the oppression Olympics. And that was 500 years of installation of these kinds of thinking. So we have to start stepping away from doing that to each other, and yep. and again, like recognizing like we are still operating under a system of white settler control, and mm-hmm. so of course like we're going to like have that, I don't know, God, what am I trying to say, like that impression or whatever of white people that is just not true, because that's like woven within years and expanses of time. So just like thinking really critically about that, and remembering that our Black kin are there to be protected by us, and we have to start doing that. So yeah, just to wrap up, I just really want to like thank you all so much for taking over the broadcast today, and really like that doing this was kind of like a response to what I've been seeing as attempts to create Black and Indigenous solidarity by like facilitating the conversation and kind of infantilizing the lives of Black people. And it's like, it's just time for us to sit down and just shut up, because y'all's indigeneity is questioned a lot more than ours and other people's, and just like really wanting to emphasize that we like belong to each other, like we're kin, and we need to reconcile that the harm that we've done to each other to strengthen that kinship alliances. And so yeah, thank you so much, and to everybody who's listening right now, like please take the words of our kin, all of our Afro-Indigenous kin, to heart, and take that to your spirit, and really do everything to smash the anti-Blackness that you see in your communities. So with that, thank you, Nawiha. I hope everyone has a really good day, and I hope to uplift all of our guests through social media too. So look for their handles in the caption of our podcast post. And of course, we'll be asking for reparations from y'all. So look for their cash apps and PayPals too in the caption. So, all right. Thank you so much, everybody.
Kiwi Glitch, and you can find this broadcast on any of the usual podcast platforms or at indigenousaction.org. And don't forget to email us pics of burning cop cars, any questions or topics you'd like to hear us go claws out on at iainfo@protonmail.com.
blazing fire that they can never stop.